G'day listeners, you are listening to the Natives Reservoir podcast. I'm your host Trent, and today I'll be discussing the Snowy Mountains Hydro Scheme in what is planned to be part of a series of episodes where we discuss Australian infrastructure. Joining me to tackle this topic is our Hobart branch governor, Jamie. How are you going, Jamie?
Yeah, really well, mate, really well. Thanks for having me on again, and how are you?
Yeah, I'm great. Great, good to have you back on. So the larger plan for today is that this is going to be part of an ongoing series where we delve into some of our historic infrastructure projects, as well as looking at some present day ones, some potential future ones, or maybe even some historic ones that didn't get off the drawing board. I think we'll definitely have to do one on the Bradfield scheme. But I decided the best place to start was with the Snowy Hydro, probably one of our best known and most ambitious projects. And it's good that you're on to do this with me, because as a Tasmanian, I figured you would be an appreciator of hydroelectric power. I think Tasmania has a little bit of a mania for hydroelectric dams. You've got about 30 of them down there. And I believe today about 80% of the state's power comes from hydro. So are you a hydro enthusiast?
Big enthusiast, mate. I even had the pleasure of growing up in my youth in the Snowy Mountains. So I guess you got the perfect guest on to talk all things hydroelectricity. Tasmania certainly does have a proud history of hydroelectricity, which we'll get into some comparisons later on, I'm sure, with some of the ambitious sort of projects they went on in the very early days of Tasmanian sort of power and the reasons behind it. But we got stacks of hydroelectricity down here, which is great, but also has a downside of encouraging what's recently been in the news is a whole lot of those AI data centers want to come and set up shop down here for the clean green energy and the cooler weather. So there's always a devil in the detail there.
Yes. And I almost forgot to mention, it's good timing. This was totally accidental, but Snowy Hydro 2.0 has been in the news the last couple of days with a report being released recently by the what's the office? The Australian Audit Office. So we'll be discussing that at the end. But as always, we start with some listener comments. David King 3699, and this was on the Tasmania episode that we did recently, Jamie. He said, "Great episode, lads. A lot of history in that little island. Good to look back to the source material rather than the rewritten revisionist version they try to feed us these days. Different times, but we are where we are today because of that history. When I look back at my ancestries, my paternal side arrived in Adelaide from Devon in 1854, yet others at the time went to Newfoundland in Canada. Gold, whaling, who knows what drew them there, but glad my ancestors chose a warmer country. We're all connected and we do have that common ancestry." I'd agree, David King. Any comments from you, Jamie?
Yeah, he's raised a good point there about the revisionism of some of our history or watering down of it, and we should all be rather proud in what our ancestors achieved on this island and the big island. The achievements should not be underrated at all.
And we'll get into a bit of that today when we're talking about the Snowy Hydro and some of the way that the project, particularly the immigrant labor, the way the history around that is framed. We'll be giving maybe a different perspective to what people are going to get elsewhere. We've got another comment from the Convict Settler Association. This one was on an episode I did with Michael for Anzac Day. And he said that speech at the end about the unknown soldier and what he represents puts a lie to everything Vizard wrote. Steve Vizard was an 80s TV icon. He did Fast Forward and also had a late night talk show. He was a product of a homogenous Australia. All of you reading this should watch more pre-90s shows. It's part of our pre-modern Australian history and we should have a cult following. Bring back Roger Ramjet. And I think is that supposed to say Roger Ramjet? I'm not sure. So thanks, Convict Settler Association. And I'm not sure if it really came across in the show. I was trying to give a serious response and take Vizard's book seriously, but I really, really didn't like it. It was like pulling teeth reading that book. Anything from you, Jamie, before we move on?
You got to be honest. If you can't pretend to like it, if you didn't enjoy it, that's for sure. And sometimes people can be a product of the era they grew up in, and it's easy to look back now from the position we're in and say, look, you know, this was wrong, that was wrong, and if you wrote it from the comfy upbringing through the 60s, 70s, and 80s, yeah, I mean, you can't really fault him for not having the foresight to predict what we're in now. So.
Oh, that's a very measured response. Very, you're not just boomer hating, and that's
good. It's easy to do. It's easy to just bash on the boomers. Yeah, I'll argue with my folks until the cows come home on how easy they had it and what they did to us. But they didn't realize, they didn't know, they didn't do these things willfully. So
yeah, that's a good point. I like your attitude on that topic. All right, moving on to our poetry segment, and today we're going to bend the rules on the poetry segment a little bit, and we're going to have a song. It's called Farewell to Jindabyne. It mourns the loss of the town of Jindabyne. The residents were moved out of the area by the government in an eminent domain case to build the Snowy Hydro Dam. The original site of the town is now about 40 metres underwater, and the town was moved to another place. Some of the residents just sold up and left. Some had their houses demolished and built new ones in the new town. And a couple of them had their homes put on trucks and carted over to the new town. So this song was written by one of the workers on the scheme, a young Irishman who came over to work on the scheme by the name of Bulik O'Boyle. And he was inspired by the story of Jindabyne and wrote what I think was initially a poem and was later put to music in a band that he formed with his wife and one of the other workers on the Snowy. I'll play us that song now. This is The Settlers with Jindabyne Farewell.
It's time to say goodbye to Jindabyne. It's been my home these 50 years of time. Now the mountains in their winter snow on the Snowy River down below are whispering farewell to Jindabyne. And now farewell, old home of mine. They're going to flood the valley and the town of Jindabyne. When I was young, my father said to me, upon this spot I'm going to plant a tree, tall and strong and made of pine, to mark the land that I've made mine, and you'll make yours, my boy, in time to be. But now farewell, old tree of mine. They're gone to flood the valley and the town of Jindabyne. I guess that it don't hurt to have my say, for the young they'll laugh and say I've had my day, and they'll dam the waters from those hills, even if an old man feels there's things around the good Lord meant to stay. Like Jindabyne, old home of mine, they're going to flood the valley and the town of Jindabyne. When Jindabyne at last becomes a lake, my eyes will see the waves, but my heart will take a trip beneath that surface blue, down the years of memory true, and this perhaps will ease my yearning ache. For Jindabyne, a dream of mine, when they flood the valley and the town of Jindabyne, my Jindabyne. Jindabyne, 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 Jindabyne.
All right, Jamie, any comments on the settlers with Jindabyne farewell?
Yeah, it's really interesting. You can feel they really felt for the town. I can, having not seen the original town and been to the current iteration of it numerous times, I can only imagine how good it was. I have had the opportunity to go across to what's called Church Island in Lake Jindabyne when the water level was really low, and I've sat on the old church steps on Church Island. So that's really interesting. If anyone gets a chance, they're in the Snowy Mountains and the water level is quite low. Yeah, definitely see if you can take that opportunity, because it's a special little moment to sort of sit there and ponder the history of a town that they drowned, essentially.
Yeah, pretty bittersweet little song. If you enjoyed that little ditty, I'd encourage you to go and look up The Settlers or look up Songs of the Snowy on YouTube. They didn't make it across to Spotify, but if you want to go and have a listen to some more of their music, I'd encourage you to do so. I like The Ballad of the Dozer Man and The Cooma Cavaliers. They've got some funny ones as well. All right, so with the poetry segment and the listener comments done, let's move on to the meat of the episodes. The Snowy Hydro Scheme, what is it? It's a huge hydroelectric and irrigation complex located in the states of New South Wales and Victoria. The construction began in 1949 and it took 25 years to complete. And it cost, when you adjust it for inflation, $8.5 billion. And it is a pretty huge undertaking. It's not, if you compare it to other of these major infrastructure projects, like say the Hoover Dam, it's more spread out, but it does compare in size. So there's 16 major dams with 7 power stations and 225 kilometers of tunnels. It catches the snow melts off the mountains that would otherwise largely flow down and out into the ocean. And when it was completed, it was producing about a third of the electricity as compared with all of the coal mined in New South Wales. So that's the little fact sheet. And I won't dive too deep into any of the engineering and construction side. There's a few good documentaries available on YouTube and iView, SBS On Demand and so on. So if you want like the engineering marvels type content, if you're into that stuff, go and look up that, because you're going to get a better product with the visuals than we could give you trying to deliver that in audio. The thing that I want to discuss about it is, why did they build the Snowy Hydro? And if we take the most zoomed out perspective we can and start with the global situation, where in a post-World War II world, Australia is now in this kind of race to industrialize. And globally, there is a shift in pretty much everything, where we've moved away. The British Empire is beginning to roll up. I wouldn't say it's over yet, but it's definitely on the way out. And we're moving into the era of the Cold War and American dominance, you know, the IMF and the World Bank. And one of the driving factors is the battle against communism. And as we know, in the post-World War One era, about a decade later, they were into the Great Depression. And the powers that be were obviously terrified of something like that happening, and then the rise of communism. So there was a shift to Keynesian economics, which is basically where the government stimulates growth by spending. So any comments on that global situation, Jamie?
Well, to start with, you often forget that it took them 25 years to build. So that's when you put that into perspective, you sort of start to wonder, wow, that's like some of the people involved in planning it, designing it, and getting it across the line may never have lived to see its completion. And it's just an incredible feat. And I know we're not getting into the engineering, but it's an incredible feat of engineering. And with 145 kilometers of tunneling back in those days, I mean, that's just incredible. And then to use it, to have the foresight. And I'm not sure, my history's eluding me. I'm not sure who was sort of in power at the time of making these decisions, but to have the foresight to Sorry.
It was Labor. Federally was in power at the time that it was announced and approved, and it swapped back and forth a number of times before it was finally completed.
Mm.
But it was a Labor government.
Yeah, so it goes to show the Labor government of old were sort of did have that foresight, and the Labor government of old and the Labor government of today are wildly different creatures. I'm sure the listeners are aware.
Yeah.
But to have the foresight to do that, as you said, that economic sort of kickstart with a big project like that is something we could probably take note of looking toward the future.
Yes, most definitely. And speaking of the Australian government and the Labor government, the next thing that I want to speak about is the Australian situation, and specifically the way that the Snowy Hydro scheme acted as a strike breaker or a counterbalance against the power of the coal miners. In 1949, there was a coal miners' strike. 23,000 coal miners walked out on the picket line for 7 weeks. This was a huge event, and it showed that the miners just really had the country by the short and curlies. Power rationing was brought in nationwide, a 75% cut in household electricity use. Cooking with electricity was banned for certain periods. And obviously with such shortages of power, a lot of factories were forced to close, and 500,000 workers were stood down. This just caused absolute economic turmoil across the country. Also, this was taking place during winter. So obviously in the southern parts of the country, in the colder parts of the country, this would have been just absolutely catastrophic. The Prime Minister at the time, Chifley, he did not view this strike as being legitimate. Even though he was a Labor man, and I'm pretty sure he came out of the rail. I'm going to do some bad podcasting and do some on-the-spot research. I'm like 90% sure. Yes. Okay. So Ben Chifley started his primary career in the rail industry, and then from there moved into the unions, and then on to the Labor Party.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep.
So he was a Labor man. He was a union. He thought that these guys were, you know, taking the piss.
What was the reason for the coal miners' strike?
Well, I think they just realised that they had the power to do it. This topic could probably serve as its own podcast episode. During the Second World War, there was the coal miners obviously kept working because they were needed. I think there was some certain promises made about what would happen after the war, and they weren't delivered on. And that's one side of the story. And then the other side of the story is the coal miners' union was infiltrated by communists, and this was a communist plot, which is what Chifley believed. Certainly, it seems like it. Because if you hear the list of demands that they were asking for, that might put some things into perspective. So the demands of the strike were they wanted their working week reduced to 35 hours. That's a pretty significant reduction in working hours. And at the same time, they wanted a pay increase of 30 shillings, which equates to about 20 to 25%. So they wanted to work 20 to 25% less and also be paid 20 to 25% more. And there were some other claims, some things like long service leave. But all in all, I think these demands were pretty exorbitant. And Chifley thought so as well. So Chifley took some really drastic actions to teach the Reds a lesson, as it were. So financial aid to the strikers was banned. You weren't allowed to donate to them. Unions were banned from paying them out of war chests. 8 of the union leaders were rounded up and put in jail. And eventually the army was deployed. So 2,500 soldiers broke picket lines and went into open cut mines in New South Wales and started digging up coal. And that was the end of the strike. That was when the strike broke. They didn't get any of their demands met. Just a pretty harrowing chapter in Australian labour history. The net sort of result of this little expedition by the coal miners' union is it tanked Chifley's government. Even though the labour base and the people probably weren't too happy that, you know, Granny was freezing because she couldn't use her heater in the middle of winter because the coal miners were all out, you know, wanting a 25% pay rise. The people didn't appreciate Chifley's strike breaking. It kind of rubbed against the grain. What this ended up doing in the long run was delivering Menzies back into power and the newly formed Liberal Party. So they used this chaos to launch themselves back into the fold. The plans for Snowy Hydro were already in the works, but this event, I think, probably it really cemented the need for this project. The vulnerability of the national power grid was really exposed, and it was decided that diversifying the sources of power was absolutely necessary. Yeah, perhaps this topic would be worth revisiting in a later episode and going into it more deeply. I'll leave it there for now.
Yeah, I think it'd certainly be really interesting to have a full episode on that, or even just a full episode on sort of the labor movement history on you know, in various facets. You know, like there's obviously, I think, did you do an episode on the Shearers strike?
I didn't, but I think Matt, so there is one.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, so that sort of stuff, rolling those all in together is really interesting, because we do have a proud labor movement history, but that one does smell like commie mischief to me.
Yes.
But I don't know. And the other question that sort of that raised for me is there any other sort of precedent set of using the army as scab labor? That's just crazy for me that the army rolled in and started digging out coal.
Yeah, not that I know of. That's I think that's definitely one way to visit.
And if it's the army, do you still call them scabs?
I don't know. Yeah, I guess so. They're crossing a picket line, so yeah.
Yeah, uncharted territory.
Yeah, and it does. There was after this, I think there was another attempt to ban the Communist Party. Interestingly, the sort of more radical members of the labor union, like the net result was Pig Iron Bob, strikebreaker extraordinaire, is returned to the prime ministership after being effectively exiled at the start of World War II. So an interesting topic. Another thing that I wanted to discuss that's possibly less interesting, it's a bit more bureaucratic, is that in 1945, the government at the time, it was a Labor government, they signed and committed to the full employment white paper. So during the Great Depression in the 30s, jobs were scarce and the poverty was pretty extreme. But then during the war, almost everyone had a job. The country needed to build weapons and supplies. The 1945 white paper was the government's promise to carry on this good situation over into the peacetime. There were fears of a repeat of the Great Depression that followed World War One. As I sort of mentioned at the top, the fears of the rise of communism added to the urgency to keep employment high that was felt by the government. Before this plan, before the full employment white paper, it was generally accepted and believed that economies naturally went through cycles of boom and bust, and that unemployment was something that just happened. This white paper, it completely changed this, and it made job security a fundamental human right and also an official government responsibility. The paper was, at the time and after it, probably for the following 30 years after it was published, it was pretty successful. Australia did enjoy a golden age of employment where the unemployment rates stayed pretty low, like usually below 2%. For reference, the current rate, I looked it up, it's 4.4%. And also a lot of the like jiggery and tomfoolery that happens with the numbers and how they count some people and don't count other people, I believe that the unemployment rate in this country is probably significantly higher than 4.4%. At this current
significantly, yes,
yeah. I think that number's I think the 2% number is for the 30 years following the introduction of this policy. I can see that the 4.4% number now. Nah, no way.
No, absolutely not. And books have been cooked.
Yes. Also, some of the other reasons that they wanted to do this were just drought proofing, because this project would allow them to irrigate, and of course the power generation that they wanted, and that would assist with not just curbing the power of the coal miners' unions, but helping industrial development. So, any comments on that before I keep rolling, Jamie?
No, I think we're good, and that's it. But it is a key point to remember that the water diversion from the Snowy to the Murray and the Murrumbidgee was an awesome sort of byproduct, and it was well thought out to divert the water. Obviously the used water and stuff to use it again is just a great bonus.
Mm. My last point on reasons why this infrastructure project was undertaken is for defence. After World War II, we realised we couldn't really rely on Britain for our defence. This turn towards America had begun. I wouldn't say it was fully cemented yet, but it was certainly something that was happening. And part of this turn away from Britain, it meant this urgency for us to develop economically. For a long time, the relationship between Australia and Britain was one where Britain wanted to receive cheap raw goods, wool, wheat, minerals, ore, and sell us back expensive finished goods. I'm not trying to upset the Anglophiles. I think that's just the way it is, and it's neither here nor there. That's what the situation was, and there's no animosity when I say that. But it was decided that this situation wasn't going to be feasible and we needed to develop economically. A lot of the funding that came through for this project, you can see we started moving towards American capital and IMF capital, World Bank capital, as opposed to Mother Britain. So now that we've discussed a fair bit of the why they built it, we'll start talking about some of the hows. How did they build it? So with the scheme being planned to cross two states, Victoria and New South Wales, the federal government decided to step in. Even though states are supposed to be responsible for their own power generation needs, the federal government used the Defence Act to push through this project, which is kind of interesting. Was that like a misuse of the Defence Act, or was this project legitimately critical for Australia's defence? I can imagine the argument where yes, it was needed for the defence of the nation, but I could also equally well make the argument that no, it probably wasn't. Do you have anything you want to weigh in on with that?
Yeah, I can't see it as a misappropriation of the funding. I think energy security and that all that other independence that you mentioned just earlier is key to our success, key to our defense essentially. And yeah, I think it's a great use of that. And it was interesting that, you know, obviously great men at the time had the mind that it was for defense essentially, to put ourselves in a better position for sure.
Yeah. Now this was controversial at the time, and perhaps it was a bit of a more of a political issue than, or made into more of a political issue than a defence issue. It was used as a battering ram against the government by the opposition or something like that. Yeah, just another interesting facet of this project is the funding model that they used. All right, and now we're going to talk about what's going to probably be a bigger part of this podcast, and that's the workforce, the migrant workforce. So a big part of the mythos around the Snowy Hydro is the immigrant workforce. And from the outset, I'll point out that the conditions of the time, as well as the immigrants themselves, are totally different when compared to today's immigrants and immigration policy and the results that we are reaping from them. So when Snowy Hydro and the immigrant workforce comes up, it's often used as something to bolster present-day immigration, and that's something that I want to push back against. Official numbers list that we had over 100,000 immigrant workers from 30 different countries. Now, I've tried to find some breakdowns on these by numbers, numbers by nationality, but I haven't been able to find anything. The question probably on everyone's lips is, why did the federal government at this time bring in such a large immigrant workforce? You know, this is a time when Australia was quite fiercely anti-immigration, and obviously that was going to change over the period that the Snowy Hydro was being built up until today. But why did the federal government want to bring in all of these immigrants to work on the Snowy Hydro? And why couldn't they just use an Australian workforce? The first reason is the economy was booming. There was work everywhere. There was more work than there was workers. There was obviously a reduction in the workforce after the Second World War. Also, the change in economic policy that I was talking about earlier, capital had been unleashed. We were in the post-war boom. There was other infrastructure projects. There was factory work, manufacturing work. There was stuff happening everywhere. People were not looking for work. Also, the Snowy Hydro was in a very remote place. The work was hard. The environment was harsh. And in order to make the scheme economically viable, the wages that would have been required to attract Australian workers, it wouldn't have worked. It would have been so expensive to draw Australians into this area to work that it would have likely made the project economically unfeasible. And also, there was some workers brought in with specialist skills. So some of the first people that were brought in were from Norway. I think 400 Alpine construction experts were brought in, various other people with specialist skills. We had some U-boat engineers from Germany. The Australian government somehow got their hands on some U-boats and scavenged the motors out of them and were using them to power pumps. Obviously, they wanted some people to work on and maintain these motors, and the best place to get them was from Germany. So they just went and got them and brought them over. Earlier, I was also talking about the threat of communism at this time and how that's a thread that was sort of running through everything and part of the motivation to take on a project like this was anti-communism. A lot of the workforce that was being imported, they were being scouted from displaced person, UN camps in Europe. And these were people who had been displaced from their home by the communists, sometimes people who had fought against them in the Second World War. And by importing them, you were effectively importing an anti-communist workforce. Also, there was some actions taken to keep more radical unionists away from this workforce that was in quite remote places. They were on work camps, and there was a bit of security enforced to keep people that were not part of the workforce from wandering onto sites and to prevent these guys from unionizing. In summarizing a lot of the arguments that we hear today about, oh, Australians don't want to do these jobs or they are not qualified to do these jobs, this is the situation at this time is the closest I think we'll ever get to that legitimately being true. When the work in Sydney is booming, you aren't going to be able to get guys to go and work on a dam in the middle of nowhere unless you pay really big money. That's just the fact of the matter. Also, with the situation with the coal miners union, you also don't want to be creating another problem for yourself where you are just trading one group of people that has your energy grid by the short and curlies for another. Any comments on that, Jamie?
There's a lot of points there, I guess. The first one being that, and you've set this up well by talking about that 2% unemployment rate. So you've got a perfect storm here and it's a good one. Like, it's a good problem to have. You've got 2% unemployment rate, and then you're taking on this monumental infrastructure project. You're obviously going to need bodies. You need the bodies to do it. You've got 2% unemployment. You've got a reduced workforce from the war. And then obviously you're going to have to make, obviously, I mean, I think somewhere in the vicinity of 30 to 35% of the workforce were local Australian workers.
Yes.
So obviously there's, you know, it wasn't just all a migrant workforce. And then when they talk about, obviously you said you tried to get a breakdown of where all these people came from, sort of by numbers. I think from memory, the largest sort of nationality was after the British, I guess. The British probably made up the majority. Was the Polish. The Polish made a significant contribution of in the workforce. And you have to think about what the Poles had been subjected to for the last, you know, little while in their part of the world, being in the tos and fros of the jaws of communism. So they've obviously wanted to come out here. The Italians came out in droves, and the Italians have their own, probably their own reasons to leave. And then the rest of that Eastern Bloc, like you said, was fighting a real hard war against communism, and given the opportunity, why wouldn't you come out? Especially given that obviously we had the reduced workforce, so we needed them. But yeah, the British were still the single largest group, and that's often, as we talked about at the very start, that's often part of the revisionism. They talk about all the other European migrants, being whether they're from Greece or Malta or those other southern European nations, but the majority was still British, British men.
Yeah, the White Australia policy had not fully wiped away, and that's
no, that's right. Yeah,
that's evident in the people that they were bringing in to do this work.
And exactly, and then when you look at the number of being, you know, circa the, you know, sources vary, and obviously the number is circa that 100,000 people. That compared to the people coming in, you know, on an annual basis now is significantly different. And obviously this is still the majority number of those 100,000, most of them were British. So to compare it to now is obviously, when people talk about it, you'll use it as a precedent. It's obviously apples and oranges. And then to say, obviously nowadays, Aussies won't do those jobs, Aussies won't, and whatever. It's like, we still made up 30% of that workforce then, and I'm sure we would do the jobs that are available now. We just like some comfortable work conditions, and that's probably going to lead into those labor movement episodes we're going to do later down the track.
Yeah, well, that is a big part of this, and something that I didn't mention. This is wage suppression, because if they wanted to do this project, they could have done
100%, it with Australians. Yep.
They just would have had to pay, and they weren't willing to do that. And that's the most salient comparison to the current immigration in the present day. And the attitude was totally different. The just sort of flinging open of the doors that we're experiencing now versus this fairly focused scouting of talent, you know, bringing in German U-boat engineers to work on the equipment that they had out in a very remote area is very different to just bringing the hordes to our inner cities so that they can deliver fast food on scooters.
I guess the other point is that maybe the Germans didn't move to Antarctica and they're all in the snowy mountains after all.
Yeah, real. That's where the entry to Agartha is. That's the
must be.
All right. So some summary on the original Snowy Hydro, and I'll run through a couple of negatives. There were some pretty bad environmental impacts. All of the people traveling into this area, they tracked in weeds. The actual Snowy Hydro scheme, it reduced river flow in a lot of areas. It caused some of the river mouths to close up, silt build up, fish die offs. There was some real and genuine damage to the environment there. Also some damage to surrounding farmlands. Some of that silt build up and some increase of salinity in the soil. Yeah, it damaged the productivity of the surrounding farmland. There has been a Snowy River restoration project, and that started in 2002. And they're trying to do some things to improve on some of those environmental problems, like flush the rivers out and improve the water quality. But as of yet, there hasn't been huge improvements. And that did start in 2002, as I said. And the other negative thing, which I already mentioned, is the strike breaking, the reduced worker negotiation power, and the wage suppression, which is a big part of this story that's never mentioned when it's told in other places. But all that being said, the scheme was overall a success. The power was generated, the land was irrigated. Another great success was how much skill was developed in the nation. The Australian steel industry, it gave them a real boost and helped them to get developed. We had the founding of some of our construction giants, companies like Thiess, I'm not sure how to pronounce that, and Kaiser. There was also some interesting engineering inventions or developments. They invented these things called rock bolts, which are pretty innovative Australian invention. They are used all over the world now when people are tunneling. They're used to secure tunnels stop them collapsing as they're tunneling, as well as some advances in seismic monitoring technology. Along with that, it helped the development of computer science in Australia. One of our first like big computers, you know, those big old computers that were the size of a, you know, size of a garage, Snowcom. That was used to control a lot of the functions of the scheme of the whole system. So that brought a lot of skill into the country. This is a cool little one. One of the workers was this Czech engineer. His name was Tony Sponar, and he was a former Olympic skier. When he was working on the hydro, when he had time off, he would go scouting up in the mountains for ski locations. And he found one and went on to found Bredbow Ski Resort. So
that's a fun fact, actually. Yeah, that's really cool.
Yeah. So yeah. You can thank the Snowy Hydro for Australia's ski resorts.
Yeah, and that's something it's easy to forget is the innovation you get as a byproduct of massive projects like this. Like you said, the Rock Bolt and then the foundation of a couple of companies there, Thies and Kaiser, sound awfully Germanic to me. But you know, there's some of those migrants, I guess, came out from and then founded some companies and employed some Aussies later down the track, which is nice. And the steel industry would have loved it for sure. I know there's a large infrastructure project happening down here in Tasmania at the moment, and I noticed there were some massive steel structures in place recently, and I found out that it was Australian steel that was sent to China for them to make it for us to make these. And it was really, really disheartening. I was thinking that the steel industry here surely should have been able to make these things, but apparently not, or apparently it would have cost too much.
Yeah, well, again, that comes down to this different attitude. The government and the nation at the time when the original Snowy was underway had this attitude of, well, we're going to do it here. We're going to figure out how to do it and get it done. Whereas now we don't quite have that attitude, and don't get me wrong. When the original Snowy was underway, there was not just that migrant labour that I was talking about, but there were professionals brought in from countries like America to assist and provide education. And that's
definitely.
It's kind of a teach a man to fish versus give a man a fish situation, and now we're in the be given a fish phase of our civilization.
Yeah, that's right. And I guess just to cut back to when you're talking about a couple of the negatives and positives of the scheme itself, and relaying back to the migrant workforce, I guess one of the big negatives you can probably look at is, and I'm not sure how familiar you are with Sydney. So the boys in the Sydney branch will know this quite well. I guess you've got the area of Five Dock and Leichhardt. Now, you can get around Five Dock and Leichhardt without speaking a lick of English. All you have to do is speak Italian and you're all good. You can go to the Italian grocer, the Italian doctor, the Italian deli. But the positive, I guess, on the flip side is in your rural towns, and I know growing up, you know, you always had the Italian painter or the Italian tiler, the Italian concreters, and it goes to show that they did bring some skills and some construction know-how and pride and definite pride in their work that we probably really are thankful for. But then the flip side is when they congregate in ethnic enclaves, it sort of diminishes that Australian culture and they just sort of live their own way again. And this was only with, you know, a few thousand, you know, 100,000 total workers. You can imagine what we're in for in the future.
Yes. That wraps up the discussion of the original Snowy Hydro scheme.
The good Snowy Hydro.
Yeah. We're gonna talk about the other Snowy Hydro now. So as I mentioned at the top of the show, the Australian National Audit Office has just released a report on Snowy 2.0. So that's why the report's been in the news a bit lately. The report that's been released, it's not good to say the least. But before we get into that, I should first explain what Snowy 2.0 is. It is a pumped hydro system. So it uses two of the existing dams, the Tantagara as the upper and the Talbingo as the lower. And what they are currently building is a 27-kilometer underground pipeline that connects these two dams, with the idea being that when the wind is blowing and the sun is shining and all of the excess power being produced by the solar panels and wind farms will be used to pump water uphill from the lower dam to the upper dam, where it will be held until the wind and solar are not producing power, and then the water will be released from the upper dam, used to spin the turbines in a hydroelectric power plant, essentially forming a giant battery. Projected power capacity of this battery would be enough to power 3 million homes for a week. This is a significantly less ambitious project than the original Snowy, which was, I'll remind everyone, 16 major dams, 7 power stations, and 225 kilometers of tunnel, whereas the 2.0 is, it uses the existing dams and it's just tunneling between them. So comparison on price, the original Snowy Hydro scheme, when adjusted for inflation, it cost $8.5 billion. To discuss the budget for Snowy 2.0 is kind of difficult. I'm going to have to give you a bit of a timeline because the budget has been continuously adjusted. So the timeline starts in March of 2017 when Malcolm Turnbull announced the project with a budget of $2 billion and with a completion date of 2021. So that sounds all right. You get your battery that gives 3 million homes a week's power for $2 million, and it's going to take 4 years. Yeah, that's reasonable. But then in December of the same year, the budget was revised to between 3.8 and 4.5 billion, and the timeline was pushed out, and completion was now scheduled for 2024. In 2019, the budget was revised again to 5.1 billion, and the completion date pushed out to 2025. So we've gone up a little bit, pushed out a bit longer. But then in 2023, the project underwent a big reset in which the budget was upped again, this time $12 billion, and it wouldn't be completed until December of 2028. The current reporting that's coming out at the moment is telling us that $11.1 billion out of that $12 billion budget has been spent. And of the 27 kilometers of tunnel, less than 10 kilometers has been dug. So we've almost burnt through the budget, and we aren't even halfway through digging the tunnel. It's not looking good. So to recap all that, this was originally planned to cost $2 billion and take 3 or 4 years. And we are now 9 years and $11 billion in the hole. Remembering that the original Snowy Hydro scheme, when adjusted for inflation, cost $8.5 billion. So a significantly larger and more ambitious scheme, costing a fair bit less.
I wish it was surprising.
Yeah.
It's just stuff like that just isn't surprising anymore. It's a really sad reflection of current era Australia, I suppose. Just to quickly put that in a comparison. So, and any excuse to bring it back to a Tasmanian victory, the Duck Reach power station down in Launceston. So they completed this power station, a hydro power station, not a fancy pumped hydro battery thing, just a normal run-of-the-mill hydroelectric power station. They completed it in 1895. This is in 1895 they managed to do this. Mind you, they only had to dig an 850-meter long tunnel, but obviously they were just using their smarts. They dug through the dolerite from the sort of existing water source that they just manipulated a bit to make some storage for a diversionary penstock, and then 850 meters of tunnel, and they dig through the dolerite. A couple of guys died in the making of it. The crazy thing is they did it early. They finished early. They finished under budget, and again, this is in 1895. By the time they dug the tunnel they were digging from either end. They came to, when they realized they were matching each tunnel up at the end, they were within an inch of accuracy, which is just is just mental in 1895. So early, under budget, within an inch of accuracy, through some dolerite, and then they just managed to turn on the lights in Launceston in 1895, which is just mental. And anyone that visits, if you visit Launceston, you can do a nice walk up to the Duck Reach power station. It's now a little museum. Obviously, it's no longer in operation because we have some bigger projects down here. But it's just ridiculous that you can just blow this out on not only on cost, obviously that's just that's ridiculous, but on the time frame as well. And it just it's a sneaking suspicion that there's just too many snouts in the trough, I think, mate, on this one.
Yeah. All right. Some of the stuff that was being built in that era that you were referring to is just it's absolutely amazing that these guys were able to, in the time frames that they did, complete some of those construction projects.
Bro, it's mental. They had to catch a to get to work every day. They had to walk up and then catch a flying fox across the gorge. So it's just up near from Cataract Gorge. They had to catch a flying fox across every day to get to work. And to get tools and equipment across, they had to go across the flying fox. Like just what they were dealing with back then and what we're dealing with now is just, I mean, it must be a comfy work site up at Snowy 2.0. Like I wonder what's on site there, the kitchen, the gym, there's probably a theater, you know, like it's just, we forget the point, I think, sometimes.
All right. Well, speaking of what's on site on 2.0, I want to run through some of the reasonings for the blowout and the top of the line reason. Number one is initial planning failures. So this was not really a well conceived idea. It was born from political expediency for Malcolm Turnbull. In the lead up to Snowy 2.0 being announced, the Australian energy market was quite unstable. South Australia had this huge statewide blackout in 2016. There was a huge storm, crazy winds, 200 kilometer an hour winds, 22 of those big transmission towers. I'm not talking about the little, you know, power poles out the front of your house, the big steel transmission towers, they were ripped out of the ground, blown over, like just bent up, mangled. When the towers failed, it caused some sort of feedback in the system. And then all of the renewables, all of the wind turbines, they had some sort of safety feature in them where they switched off. What would have just been like a blackout that was localized to the areas where these towers were damaged by the storm then became much larger because there was not enough power feeding into the grid. And then it caused this kind of cascade. Adelaide at that time used to get some of their power from Victoria. When all of the renewables, all of the wind turbines shut themselves down, this automatic system tried to draw more power from Victoria to fill the need in the system. And it fried transfer stations and the entire state of South Australia went dark. Now, obviously, this was a huge problem. It cost the South Australian like hundreds of millions of dollars in just think of all the supermarkets and them having to throw out everything in their freezers and cold cases. After that, there was a big debate around these renewables. And while they didn't cause the issue, it was this storm, this once in a 50 year or once in a 100 year storm, they certainly exacerbated the problem. So a number of things came out of this. I don't know if you remember this, Elon Musk built Tesla's big battery in South Australia.
Spruiking that.
Yeah, so that was one of the things that came out of that. They did some other stuff to like strengthen up the grid. But while this was happening and there was a lot of anxiety about power in South Australia, just following it, Hazelwood Power Station, which was a power station in Victoria that produced about 20% of Victoria's power, they announced that they would be shutting down with 5 months' notice. That plant, it was due for some expensive maintenance. It had some expensive maintenance coming up. And the majority shareholder was, for some reason, the French government. And the French government wanted this coal power plant off the books so it could meet its climate targets, as obviously the French were signed up to the 2015 Paris Accords on all the climate stuff. So this closure, when Hazelwood shut down, it saw energy prices spike by 85% in Victoria the following year. Turnbull, at the time, his PM, he's under pressure. Within his own party, the party's split. You've got the right faction. They want conventional. They want coal power. The left faction, which Turnbull is a part of, they want to go down the renewables path. And Snowy Hydro 2.0 struck that bit of a compromise because it was renewable, it was the battery, and it was going to rely on the solar and the wind farm. But it kept the right faction of the party happy because it was traditional. It had this callback to the original Snowy Hydro and the industrialization and an era gone by of Australian infrastructure. It was on that note that it was decided that Snowy 2.0 would go forward. So it wasn't this like really well considered, you know, this was the best option. Quite probably it would have been the best option to just build another coal-fired power plant and solve the energy problem.
Or even someone else take over the one that closed down and do the work that was required and get it up and running. I mean, it's going to be a fraction of the cost of everything else. And then they come in and look like the heroes anyway. I just can't believe that the French would do that. Was the emissions from that coal-fired power station, was that attributed to the Frenchies' emissions or something? It doesn't make much sense to me.
Yeah, I believe so, because it was... It's just
crazy.
Yeah, because it was considered their assets. So that's a little summary of the initial planning issues. So not the best idea before you've even got started. And then as soon as they did actually get started and they broke ground, they started tunneling, they got 150 meters into the tunnel and they hit some soft sand and the tunnel boring machine got bogged and they couldn't get it out for 19 months. Which set the tone for how the rest of the project was going to go.
I find this completely ridiculous. Like, this is surely all in projects like this, like in any big infrastructure project, all the money at the start goes into planning and feasibility. And one of the first things you do is work out obviously where you're going and what you're going through. That they didn't know what the contents were, assuming they didn't know what the actual physical makeup of that part of the rock was. Down to 150 meters, just blows my mind. I mean, the guys from the AGM will know you can just use a ground penetrating radar and you'll know exactly what's there. So shout out to those boys. And it's just 150 meters into a 20 kilometer tunnel. That is crazy. How do you think the rest of the tunnel is going to go?
Yeah, I didn't probably highlight it properly, but when I was doing the history of the budget, like the timeline, so in March, Turnbull announced the project, $2 million and 2021. In December of that same year, the budget was upped and the time frame was pushed out because in December of that year, the feasibility study was completed. So this was announced and the money was allocated before the feasibility study came in. When I say the top of the line issue with Snowy 2.0 was the initial planning failures, I'm not joking.
So what did this feasibility study say, Mr. Trent?
I think it said, yeah, we can do it, but it's going to take longer and cost more than you have allocated. I think they've done several more feasibility studies since and they all say the exact same thing.
That sounds about right.
All right, we're nearly through this. So yeah, they got 150 meters in, the tunnel boring machine got bogged. They did eventually get it out, but they've had other issues with it getting bogged. They've had some minor collapses. They've had caverns and sinkholes opening up. Oh, the other thing, there was a toxic gas leak. So when the tunnel boring machine got stuck, the ground was too soft for it. So they were pumping and injecting, you know, concrete and this polyester foam into the ground to try and harden the ground up so the machine could move forward. And the foam caused a chemical reaction, releasing some toxic gas, and work had to be halted until life support refuge chambers were installed in the tunnels. That's in addition to, as I'm sure there are, the tennis court and spa.
That's right. I just quickly looked up because they named all the tunnel boring machines.
Yeah,
obviously like you name a ship, I guess. Yeah, so they named all the tunnel boring machines. The Lady Eileen Hudson. Named after the original Snowy Scheme ambassador and wife of the Commissioner Sir William Hudson, Kirsten, honouring an astrophysicist, Kirsten Banks, Wiradjuri woman, Galactic Archaeology, Florence, named after Florence Violent McKenzie, Australia's first female electrical engineer, and Monica, named after a 15-year-old high school girl. who won an art prize. I wonder how much it cost to come up with the names.
Oh, they would have paid some consultancy firm a couple of G's to do that.
Yeah, surely. Yeah.
Yeah. All right. Other factors slowing down work. They had some minor native title issues. I don't think that slowed things down too much, but just something that that the original Snowy didn't have to contend with. And
I'm surprised they didn't run into more of that, actually.
It is surprising. They've dug up apparently a heap of artifacts which have been handed over. Yeah, they've somehow skirted the title issues. I would have thought that they would have been stopped every couple of meters. Well, they did end up stopped every couple of meters anyway, but I thought they would have been stopped every couple of meters to negotiate with the local mob.
I'm sure Turnbull done some backdoor hand-wringing for that one.
Yeah. All right, so that kind of concludes what I have to say on Snowy 2.0. And the questions that I have for you, there's two of them. Is this project even worth it, one? And secondly, and probably more importantly, are we capable of completing big infrastructure projects like this in our country anymore?
So to the first one, this doesn't seem in any way worth it. Maybe it was worth it under the original projections of time and cost, maybe.
Mm.
But then when you think about what else you could have invested that money into, but even if it had to be solely for energy infrastructure, what you could have done with that money is incredible for the nation as a whole, as opposed to just, you know, sort of a smaller region. I haven't done the figures, but and I'm a nuclear power enjoyer myself. I haven't done the figures on how many reactors you could have up and running in that sort of time frame for that cost. But I'm sure that's much more feasible. And the second question: can we even do these infrastructure projects like this anymore? And unfortunately, the answer really is not well. As you can see, we can't even get the projections of cost and time right. We can't even wait for the feasibility study to be out before we start, because we need to get some political points that we started this project, or I came up with this idea, or this was me, or whatever. It seems ridiculous. Whereas the great man of the original Snowy had the foresight to see that it was, you know, to even use, like we said, the defense budget, to see that it was for the defense of the nation to have our own energy infrastructure solidified and be more independent from those bigger nations. But we're not looking that far ahead anymore. All they're doing is looking at the next political cycle, and it's a poor reflection. But I guess the white pill in there is that we can certainly look to turning these things around. And one of those upcoming episodes you mentioned, being the Bradfield scheme, is one of those such projects that we must endeavor to do.
Mm. Yeah, that's well said. And I think you've hit the nail on the head. If I can summarize some of what you said, well, I think you even said it before, too many snouts in the trough.
Oh man, big time. Yeah. You see it with all the sort of infrastructure projects now or anything. It's just, you'd really like to do a deep dive and someone do a proper audit, not just a token audit like they've done and just said, oh no, it's actually going to cost this much. I'd like to see a full deep dive audit on exactly where money went, because that's our money. I'd like us to be able to see and be shown and exactly where it went, but they'll never do that, because there would literally be riots, I'd imagine, because it's just, you just realize where it's gone and you go, you spent how much on XYZ? You got to be kidding, you know, like, because it can't cost that much to just dig some holes.
Indeed. All right. Well, if you didn't have anything else, Jamie, let's wrap up.
No, I think we covered that pretty well, mate. And I look forward to the next, big infrastructure projects. I'm sure you'll do one on the Sydney Harbour Bridge with one of the Sydney boys.
Yes. Yep. Yeah. Definitely. Well, we'll have to plot out the course on what we're going to do next. And I think I'd like to see us do one where we just discuss like potential future ones. The historic ones are good, but doing some discussions on some nation building would be fun. I'm glad that we took the time to discuss this topic. There's a lot of information out there about the Snowy Hydro scheme, but most of it is honestly really misleading, particularly about the reintegration. And I hope the audience enjoyed our discussion of this subject from the nativist perspective, discussing infrastructure and nation building and constructing a shared positive vision for the future in this country is really important. and delving into some of our successful historic nation building projects like the Snowy, and maybe some of our less successful, more recent projects like Snowy 2.0 is just the first step in that. As I said at the top of the episode, we want this to be part of a series where we expand on this topic. So I hope you'll join us again in future for the other ones. So let us know in the comments what topics you'd like to hear about from us, or if there's any particular topic relating to Australia or the ANA that you would like us to do a show on. As always, I'd encourage all of our supporters in the audience to make sure you like and subscribe and share our content far and wide. We'd love to share our show with as many good Aussies as possible. And lastly, if you want to reach out, you can find us at oznatives.org. Thank you.
Give me a man who's a man among men, who stole his wife's collar and put down his pen. Blow down a mountain and build you a dam, bigger and better than old Uncle Sam. So it's roll, roll, roll on your way, Snowy River, roll on your way, roll on your way until Judgment Day. Snowy River, roll. Sometimes it's raining and sometimes it's hail, sometimes it blows up a blizzardly gale. Sometimes there's fire and sometimes there's flood, and sometimes you're up to your eyeballs in mud. But it's roll, roll.